online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour with Callie Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
G'day. How are you going this afternoon? Did you get any action in the storm activity yesterday? If you did, I'd love to hear from you. 0487 993 222. Let me know how conditions are at your place, whether you're in the rain or not. How's the season shaping up? 0487 993 222. And this week hasn't just been a big week for discussion about Australia's trade relationship with the United States, and by virtue of that, conversation with China. It's also been some big discussions with one of our most important trading relationships and one of the closest. Industry and government heavyweights from Indonesia and Australia have met in Sydney to talk about expanding trade between the two countries. Now, they are both a part of the ASEAN-Australia-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, and there's also bilateral economic agreements fostering cooperation between businesses, communities and individuals in the two countries. David Claughton filed this report.
The Australian government launched its Southeast Asia Economic Strategy at this event and put up $2 billion to boost investment in the region. I spoke with companies and government representatives from both countries to discuss the situation in Indonesia and the opportunities and challenges to development and trade.
Harry, I'll just start with you, trying to create a sense of how big the Indonesian economy is now, because my understanding is it's now in the top 10 in the world. Would that be right?
Yeah. I mean, we got a lot of growing middle income, and then the population of 270 million. It's a big economy, largest in Southeast Asia. And definitely we would like to get more investment coming from Australia, but also vice versa, Indonesian company more and more setting up a business in Australia. So it got both ways. We already got the IIJFA as well in 2020. So it's a good time to exercise and increasing the number of investment between both countries. Yeah.
And there has been massive investment in infrastructure in the country too. What's been going on there?
Yeah, there's a new development of a fast speed high-speed train from Jakarta to Bandung. And then there's a new project inside in Jakarta City, a new stage of MRT project. And then we just move our capital city to Nusantara. It's in Kalimantan or Borneo.
A whole new capital.
Yeah, the and this is going to be like a green city with 10-minute concept. It means that all the transportation going to be green, and to traveling from one point to another is only need 10 minutes. So we would like to create a very clean cities as well. Yeah.
A very diverse geography, 6,000 dialects. So how does it empty?
17,000.
17? Yeah, but okay, that's a lot of dialects.
That's why the connectivity is very important. That's why we also developing airports, new airports, also building this, what we call as CITOL. So we build a lot of ports across Indonesia to lowering the logistic costs inside.
Right. Now, in terms of the farming value, you work with in the ag sector. How do you describe the farming situation in Indonesia?
So, yeah, we have so many potential in terms of agriculture. Around 33 million smallholder farmers in Indonesia.
33 million?
Yeah,
it's most dominated by them. It's like 150 CEOs in Australia.
Don't be amazed, because the land ownership of each farm is only a quarter of hectare.
Wow. Yeah, okay. So their production is very small.
Right, true. And yeah, the production is small, and then in some other countries in Southeast Asia, they can produce like 15 tons of chilies per hectare.
15 tons of chilies, did you say? Okay, yeah. As I heard someone also mentioned potatoes.
The
production gap is very big between production in other countries and
the chilies. The first is, well, in Indonesia, you can only produce like 8 to 10 only. So the gap is huge, and yeah, potatoes as well. One of the countries in Southeast Asia can produce like 30 to 35 tons per hectare. But for Indonesia's case, on average, it's only 18 tons.
I'm assuming that's because the technology in agriculture is still pretty limited, that mechanization would be limited, is that why?
Yeah, but I think it's the problem is centered into
farmers' knowledge in doing farming, and then so many manual laborers. There's no seeds, and then agriculture such as fertilizers and pesticides. The gap is still huge. Yeah, so that's why I think it's very important for us to collaborate with them in terms of how to find solutions that is relevant, that is focusing to increase of scaling the capacity in agriculture. Yeah. Because as you know, maybe our new president has a very ambitious mission, which is how to get Indonesia independent in terms of food security, right?
So to become independent in terms of food production.
Yeah, in terms of food production, okay.
Now, there's a couple of Australian companies here working in Indonesia and some extraordinary projects, like your company, Guy, are building a massive number of hospitals and clinics. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we're undertaking a project to do 23 hospitals and 650 medical clinics.
It just seems like a lifetime.
Over 30 years. I'm not sure I'll be there to see the last of them being built, but that we're certainly trying to, grow the standard of international healthcare available to all Indonesians. There's probably, and Pahari mentioned the growing middle class, there's probably in excess of $2 billion worth of healthcare being exported offshore by people that just don't have enough trust in the healthcare system that they're going
to the table somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely, and certainly it's not isolated to Indonesia. There's a lot of countries that had the same issue. But what we can do is assist in lifting that healthcare standard by bringing green hospitals to Indonesia. So that's another thing. We're looking at the real threat of climate change. Need some action. So we're bringing green hospitals to Indonesia, working with Indonesian companies. So it's not just about us coming here and saying, hey, we're the experts. We are experts, but we certainly have experts within Indonesia. The level of service, customer service here is outstanding in Indonesia.
And it's possible to do things faster, isn't it? Like David Mansell, you've got a factory there producing contact lenses, WA company, and you said that things can happen quickly.
Yeah, they can. Absolutely right. In fact, Indonesians generally are remarkably resourceful. And if there's things that need to get done, they just get it done. Once you understand how the system works up there, things move quickly. They certainly encourage business investment, and where we are is a special economic zone on the island of Batam, so they want foreign businesses to be there. So they give you any support you can to get stuff done. So
there was an interesting question from the floor about that. You know, what would you do differently? And you set up outside one of those centres, but you think in the end, actually, that's not a bad framework for a company to use.
That's exactly right. I think if you're getting started, that extra, in simple terms, that extra rent that you need to pay to get that support, highly recommend it, because it's a different place, like everywhere in the world. It's different, and they give you a level of support which is invaluable.
Harry, you made a comment that cracked a bit of a laugh from the audience about the investment jungle. Like, what is it like to try and get investment up or to build a business in Indonesia?
Yeah, it is a jungle if you're new to Indonesia, maybe. But then again, I already mentioned that the government have done so many efforts. We try to doing the streamlining in business processing, business licensing, so it's easier for the investor to navigate in Indonesia. So like I mentioned before, if it's your first time investing in Indonesia, it's better if you come to the Ministry of Investment or you're working with the organization. And maybe also working with some other platforms provided by the Australian government like Catalyst, and then also you can contact DFAT in Indonesian office. So,
are there many sort of ag firms or mining companies working in Indonesia?
Yeah, currently we got one big investment coming from Australia in mining sector. The company now mining and processing nickel in Morowali in Sulawesi. Yeah.
Yes. And that's having a huge impact, isn't it? Because that could be a massive industry for Indonesia.
Yes, actually, we need a lot of expertise and also technology from Australian company to helping us with the downstreaming industry project, because we would like to give more added value to our resources. That's why we would like to invite Australian company to set up a downstreaming industry, especially related to the mineral resources in Indonesia, yeah.
That's Hario Sadewa, Director of the Indonesian Investment Promotion Centre. You also heard from Bayu Sieli Rachmat, co-founder of Elevarm, which is working with farmers in Indonesia. Aditya Kamath from Argor Capital Management, David Massel from WA lens manufacturer Gelflex, and Guy Barnard from Aspen Medical. A trade delegation from Indonesia will come to Australia in the next few months to help develop trade relationships.
David Claughton with that report. It's a 12:15. This is the Queensland Country Hour. You can send me a message today, 0487 993 222. I'm going to stay with Indonesia because that country is moving towards a requirement for all imports to be halal certified, which is already affecting some Australian exporters. Indonesia has a largely Muslim population, and halal certification is about ensuring the ethical treatment of animals, humane slaughter practices, and avoiding things like pork and alcohol. Gary Embleton is the Chief Operations Officer with consultancy firm Ozfine, which specialises in beef and dairy exports. He tells David Claughton that Indonesia has huge potential, but changes to the halal regulations will need to be ironed out.
There is a massive opportunity, and we're all on board with that. We put a lot of time and effort into it. The challenges are real. Red tape is a big thing there. There were to be new halal regulations coming a month or so ago. They've been delayed by 2 years through a lot of effort and lobbying to say no one was ready for it. It was particular worry into the meat business around additional labelling requirements, getting down from box level labelling down to individual piece labelling, for example. All of the accreditations had to be redone. So in the food business, we're very used to halal accreditation. But this was a re-registration, effectively, of all of the halal accreditations.
So double handling.
It was certainly a reproduction of a lot of work that had already been done and some pretty significant additional paperwork requirements around getting that approved as well.
So that won't be happening for another 2 years, you say?
Up to 2 years, but it's part of a much wider halal regime that's being implemented there, and the ultimate aim is that in another 10 years' time, virtually every product a consumer buys in Indonesia is expected to have some kind of halal attestation. In the food space, it's less of a worry, we're used to it, but it's going to bring it into, you know, a kitchen table or a knife set or you name it that anyone buys in Indonesia, they'll be going to looking for some kind of halal attestation with it.
So in the meat sector, it goes to how it's slaughtered. Yeah, but in the dairy sector, how does it impact that?
Yeah, so you've got ingredient space. So if you think in cheese, what's the rennet that's going into the cheese, for example?
Rennet?
Yep. Rennet is part of the ingredient that gets the cheese started. So your starter cultures and rennet to form the coagulation that brings the cheese about. Historically, that is sourced from animal product. So beef, for example. Now a lot of it is a non-animal rennet starter, but it is an at-risk product, whether it be under halal or also under kosher requirements as well.
And what's the belief behind that requirement?
It's an Islamic requirement, wanting to make sure that everything a consumer touches there, you know, you've got a huge Islamic population in Indonesia, similar to Malaysia. The requirements in Indonesia and Malaysia are far tighter than they are even trading to the Middle East. But this is part of the, you know, wanting to make sure they're assuring their population that they are getting the purest possible food from a halal perspective. The other thing I'd probably add is around a school nutrition program, which is a huge platform for the new president coming in.
So he wants every kid to have a good lunch. Yeah. Is there an opportunity there for Australia?
Huge opportunity, not just for Australia. This is an opportunity that no single country will be able to service the entirety of it. By my calculations, at full capability, that will use somewhere around about 2.5 billion litres of milk equivalent going into that program. Australia's milk intake of around about 8 billion, a third of our milk intake equivalent going into that program.
In terms, we'd be well placed to deliver that, wouldn't we?
Well, we're certainly well placed. At the moment, there's a lot of talk, and it will happen, where they're trying to increase the domestic industry. So the import of heifers is a hot-button topic right at the moment, and establishment of farms. The advice that we're giving on it is we've got to make sure they've got the farm practices, the pathway to market, the processing capability, the animal health side of things has to be really well lined up before you go too strong into that. There are existing dairy farms in Indonesia doing a great job into the local milk, but it's going to be a combination of powdered milk recombined in countries, some additional local milk production. No single solution will cover the magnitude of what this program is, which is a fantastic ambition. You know, lift the nutrition of the young people in country. We've got to support that.
Gary Embleton from consultancy Ausfind speaking to David Claughton. You can share your view on that story, 0487 993 222. If you want to share your views on the opportunity in Indonesia, I'd love to hear them. And let me know too how things are going at your place in terms of the wild weather we've had over the last few weeks. If you caught any action in that storm yesterday, 0487 993 222. It's 20 past 12. Up next, a bit of a change of pace. Now, this story might be confronting, but it's one you do not want to miss.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, I'm sure this story will move you, but a warning. It is one you may also find confronting and potentially triggering, but I'm going to introduce you to Macca. Macca was attending a bushfire in Western Australia's far south when a sudden change of weather caused a firestorm to engulf his fire truck. He barely made it out alive, and he still wrestles with the emotional toll of that day. But as he shares his powerful story, he has a message for anyone who's tried and maybe dismissed counselling. If at first you don't succeed, Macca says, try again.
Twelve years ago, volunteer firefighter Macca was helping contain a fire on the south coast of WA when the unimaginable happened.
I was told it was probably about 1,200 degrees, 1,300 degrees, 23,000 kilowatts of energy per square metre. It's not a survival event. October the 12th, 2012, I was tasked with the day to putting up prescribed burn boundary signs around Partalup, Perilup, Mount Barker, north of Denmark area. Yeah, quite a interesting day. From then on, it was just driving through rivers and creeks, trying not to get bogged and put the signs up and find my way around. I did hear on the radio there was a fire reported early on. I think it was about 9:30 or something like that. And I just monitored the radio to see if I got called out for it. Didn't get called out for until probably about 12:30. I just made it back to my office and got told that I'd been asked to go across to the Albany office, and I was taking another person from the Warpol crew. They were driving over in their own vehicle. I'd follow them through. They'd drop their vehicle off and we'd go to the office, get a briefing, and then go out on site. And what we were tasked to do was to do some prescribed burning to the northeast of where the fire was working. And we had a couple of hours before the trough changed and the southwest turned and came in. Yeah, went to the site with another crew from Warpol. There was two other trucks already on site and they'd already started the burning process. This is prescribed burning, so these are just fire spots and lines that have been put in by people to edge. It was only about 20 centimetres high at the time, a couple of metres run up to the side of the truck, and the southwest change came through right at that point, and the fire picked up to about 8 metres in flame height, and Freebs had to run around the side of my truck for protection, and I moved my truck across in front of his car so he could get back into the car, and then my truck started failing. Moved forward and then it completely stopped. And at about that time we already had fire inside the cab. The map book was on fire, all the paperwork that we got from the control point was peeling off and starting to burn. The roof, the carpet lining in the truck was on fire. All the fire blankets were wrapped up in plastic envelopes. All the plastic was on fire. Charlene's bag was on fire. Window fell out from the driver's side because they're all electronically glued on from the outside. They got preheated on the outside and the glue just let go. So that just let more fire in. And then probably about 45 seconds later, the actual fire ran over the top of us. And, yeah, never felt so small.
Yeah. I'm sorry to take you back to that day. That must have been frightening.
It is now. Mm. It wasn't then. It was interesting. But it was at that time when we were in the cab, I was like, oh, this is not good. And it
sound silly, but I thought, well, we're going to die if we stay here. I see the truck in front of me was okay, it looked okay. My goal was, well, if I stay here, I die. If I go outside, I'm going to get burnt. Mm. I'll probably die, but I might be able to get in there and survive. So I grabbed Charlene and went running towards the truck. So kept going, and we got to the truck, and the doors opened, and people exited the truck. They threw themselves out. From there, it seemed to get worse. It was like, oh, no. Then again, I thought, okay, now I'm dead. But things changed again, picked people up and crawled our way back out, and have no idea how we did it. Someone was looking after us, but I keep getting told it's not a survival event for 10 minutes after the event. Freebs and Pino came back in and picked us up and got a volunteer truck, chucked us on the back, chucked them in the front. And we went back to the control point, which was now a triage. Then we all got moved to the Albany Hospital.
Macca and his fellow volunteers were badly burned, but he was discharged from hospital on the same day as the fire.
It was probably 6 o'clock in the afternoon, so the burn over incident was around about 3 o'clock. I had fixed them all from my head to my toes. I had my socks and my jocks on, and I was given two envelopes, one with Panadine Forte and one with a script for Panadine Forte, and they said I was right to go, and they walked me out the door. Didn't really have any idea where I was going, but I was going out the door, and my mother-in-law, my wife and 3 kids walked up the steps at the same time. They didn't really recognise me. Wow. And they were looking at me like, why are you leaving? And I said, they said, I'm right to go. I'm good. And I think probably about that time, the adrenaline ran out. Shock set in. Had nothing on me. Lost everything in the truck. Asked if I could use the phone to call my boss back at Walpole. Called. They thought we were all dead because it disappeared off the smart screen. And I told them I'm fine, going home, and I hung up. I hopped in the car, 3 kids, 3 baby seats, it's a 5-seater. My wife had to sit behind her mum. She drove in the footwell, and I just sat in the passenger front seat. I got to probably a couple of k's down the road, just the opposite of the Shire building, or the city of Albany Shire building, and just all the fix mold and all my blisters just kept coming, and it all just kept burning. I don't remember it, but I got them to pull over and try and look for a tap or a hose to hose myself down. And so the kids had been at swimming lessons all day, and so they put towels on me and just hosed me down on the side of the road. They told me that I should go back to the hospital, but I think I was pretty nasty. But I said, no, I'm right to go. I wanted to go home. I needed to go home. Mm. So they got me back in the car, and I don't really remember too much other than I think I went into the shower at home, and after that, I don't know if I passed out or whatever, but I think I gave in. I think I had nothing left. And they took me to the Denmark Hospital. Got painkillers, morphine, showered. They pulled all the dressings off, started again. Beautiful lady called Helen Miller. She had years of experience with the burns unit. She came in, cut everything off, and looked after me from then on. And that's about it, really.
The physical healing took almost a year, but even now, Macca is still coming to grips with the mental health impact of that day.
They did try back then. They did organise counselling as a group for everyone. But wasn't the right type of counselling, just wasn't really suited to what was going on. I worked it out in my head. I've seen 11 different counsellors, psychologists, psychiatrists over the time, and it's been a rollercoaster trying to find something that works. something that I can grab hold of and get to the next step. There was a chaplain that we had with DEC at the time. He came down and he just said, you've got to find bits and pieces that help you put it together yourself, because you're never going to get one size fits all. You just got to keep trying and trying to find stuff. And what works for you may not work for someone else. But if you don't, it's not going to get better. And yeah, it took me 11 different people, but over that time, I got something from most of them I could come away with and build on. Just found that I got to a point with a lot of them I wasn't getting any more, and tried different techniques, different treatments and whatnot. You're always hoping something will miraculously work, but yeah. And the people that I work with, I had a whole lot of support from peer supporters there, being similar sort of events or being through trauma themselves. They were really great. Just the empathy side of things. You didn't really have to explain. That's the tiring thing, is trying to explain to someone over and over again. That whole process is so draining. Most of the time they were just there, a cup of coffee, you know, sit and have a chat.
Macca has post-traumatic stress disorder, but managing a mental illness in the country can be tough.
Hard. I brought up in a family that just thought it was just weak-minded people. Still a thought that's there in my mind, and it's like, yep. Or if you suffer from mental health, you're just soft. You give up after a while, and you just got to know. I was lucky enough that I had a really good doctor. I had really good support from my work colleagues, and it did help immensely. And after a while, I did ask, I need help. I really do need help.
He's still managing his PTSD day to day, so the fight's not over. But Macca's not one for giving up.
No, it's not something I ever thought I'd suffer from. And I don't want anyone else to have to suffer from it. But I see lots of people having to respond and do things, and it's still got a stigma attached to it. Still has. Country people talk about it all the time, Are You Okay Day. It's all talked about, but it's not, there's no real substance to a lot of it. I mean, I still feel nervous chatting to people. I don't like the fact that I suffer from mental health issues. I don't want to tell too many people. I don't want to put it out there too much. It affects everything from your ability to get a job to your day-to-day work life, your day-to-day family life. But you can have an okay life, or a pretty good life, if you work through it and try and help, try and get help. If it doesn't work, try something different. There are lots of things out there. There are lots of people out there that are really good. You just got to find the right person that helps you.
Macca, from Denmark in Western Australia. He was speaking to Richard Hudson about his post-traumatic stress disorder. And you can read his full story on the ABC Rural website. There's lots of great advice there too for anyone suffering with PTSD, or anyone who loves someone who is. And if you need help, or someone you know does, please call Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636. It's 1300 224 636, or Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14 to reach Lifeline. You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour. We'll check in with the Weather Bureau next.
After a crisis, you'll have good days and bad days, and so will those around you. Talking about it is a good place to start. Talk to your friends and family, talk to your colleagues or your neighbour. If negative feelings are persisting, it might help to see your GP. You can also call Beyond Blue or Lifeline. Get more recovery tips from the Australian Red Cross or at abc.net.au/emergency.
This is the Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's coming up to 25 to 1. Peter Clarkson's on duty at the Weather Bureau this afternoon. How are you, Peter?
G'day, Callie. Yeah, well, thank you. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Where did we see the peak of the activity in that storm action yesterday?
Yeah, so yesterday afternoon and into the evening, storm stretched from the Gulf Country right through the Central Highlands and into parts of the Wide Bay, Darling Downs and Southeast Coast. Top falls were around the Wide Bay, where we saw two rounds of storms, so yesterday afternoon, and then again, a few storms overnight in those in that region, so up to 96 millimetres at Munna Creek. A number of other locations in that region, sort of 80 to 95, just inland of sort of the Hervey Bay region there, and yeah, elsewhere right across the Darling Downs, southeast Queensland, widespread falls sort of in the 10 to 30 millimeter range, and some scattered to isolated falls getting up sort of over 50 millimeters in parts as well.
And how are things shaping up for today?
Yeah, so for today, a little bit of a rewind and play it back again, I'd say. So yeah, those storms once again stretching from the Gulf Country through central Queensland and into the Wide Bay, southeast coast. Maybe not as active around the Darling Downs today as yesterday. That's the one sort of difference I can pick out. Mm. But we do have a risk of seeing severe thunderstorm activity again right across the Central Highlands, into the Wide Bay and down into eastern parts of the Darling Downs and the southeast coast. Damaging winds, large hail, heavy rainfall all possible, and even giant hail possible in parts of far southeastern Queensland for today. So it should be quite an active afternoon and evening ahead for us. But yeah, still pretty hot across large parts of the state. We do have that heat wave warning in place. So a severe to extreme heat wave in place across the northern interior, as well as the western peninsula and eastern Gulf Country at the moment. So for places in these areas already seeing temperatures exceed 40 degrees for today. Winton's well over 40 degrees already, and that's following overnight temperatures sort of in the mid to high 20s in parts, so not much reprieve unfortunately for those places. There might be a very isolated afternoon storm in some locations, but unfortunately not enough to really cool things down too much. And I should mention as well, Weipa yesterday in the Western Peninsula setting a new November record for temperatures for them. 39.6 wow. degrees is their new November heat record.
Wow. And so no real sign of much relief in terms of those temperatures over the next few days?
Not a lot. So certainly tomorrow and over the weekend, continuing to see large parts of the far northern interior and eastern Gulf Country at least exceed 40 degrees following overnight temperatures in the mid-20s. We do potentially see some relief as a bit more rainfall and potentially even a patchy cloud band may come across sort of early to mid next week. So for some parts, that's dropping things more down into the lower 30s. So that is probably likely to be some welcome relief, but just a few more days of some very hot weather to get through first.
Now, you did mention some of that thunderstorm activity pushing into the Central Highlands, getting more into the central Queensland kind of area. Are we expecting the potential for intense rainfall amongst those cells?
Yeah, probably not intense rainfall. Mm-hmm. It's more the higher end of hail and wind risk that we do see in the Wide Bay and southeast coast today. But that central Queensland region will become a bit more of the focus again from tomorrow, and potentially some higher rainfall figures there with isolated heavy rain possible again tomorrow through that central highlands region and into the Wide Bay again. Darling Downs the focus. And then over the weekend, we see a bit of a ridge build along the Queensland coast. It'll return a few showers to the north tropical coast, and it will push the focus of those storms and severe storms actually into western Queensland. So that's something we haven't really seen for a little while, but they'll push across the southern interior and into parts of western Queensland as the focus over the weekend before that cloud band I mentioned sort of tracks across the state from early next week. And there might be a little bit of rainfall, at least across the south as that tracks across as well.
And what does all this mean for the conditions on the coastal waters?
Yeah, so fairly light winds at the moment on coastal waters, quite a weak ridge in place. So for most, not really getting above 15 knots anywhere apart from potentially central Queensland up to 20 knots. And then we do see a bit of a strengthening of those coastal waters as that ridge builds over the weekend. Probably not into strong wind warning territory, but at least getting up to 25 knots in parts by the weekend.
Well, we'll keep an eye on the radar as always, Peter. Thank you very much for your time on the Country Hour today.
No worries. Thanks, Kelly.
It's 20-1. I'll take you to the Black Hall sale and we'll check in on the Warwick weekly sheep sale as well before 1 o'clock. This is the Country Hour.
During a heatwave, there are things you can do to make yourself more comfortable. Wear lightweight and loose-fitting clothing. Stay indoors out of the heat. Take cool showers and splash yourself with cold water or use a damp cloth. If you don't have air conditioning, go to a shopping centre, community hall, museum or library. For more tips, visit the ABC Emergency website, abc.net.au/emergency.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
It's hoped a project to trial new technology on Australian farms could see Queensland's vegetable growers reduce their input costs and potentially even ease some labour shortages. It's early days for the $4.1 million Hort Innovation Program, but it's already hitting a few milestones, including running an international study tour to show growers the type of tech that could be brought to Australia. DPI Principal Development Horticulturalist Julie O'Halloran takes Ashley Bagshaw through what's on offer for farmers.
We're here talking about a project looking at advanced vegetable mechanisation to address cost and labour efficiencies. So that program is funded by Hort Innovation through the Vegetable Levy Fund. It runs for 3 years. The project did only commence in May of this year, so we're still in the early stages. So we've got a program of activities. They include 2 webinars a year where we are connecting Australian growers with global technology manufacturers, specifically looking at automation and mechanisation options for the field production phase of vegetable cropping. And we've had the first one of those webinars was in July this year, where we had a couple of Australian vegetable growers as part of a panel session, as well as technology pitches by 3 international technology companies.
So what sort of technology are we talking about here?
So there's a range of technologies. Some of them are automated, so it's reducing the need for an operator to actually be physically operating the machine. And others are more about mechanisation, so you're looking at perhaps different ways of doing farm operations like weeding, things like that. So perhaps reducing use of chemistry for more mechanised cultivation to take out weeds, more targeted in your use of chemistry. So that's, again, optimising use of some of those crop inputs by using less because you're actually targeting more specifically where you're going to put them.
Is there any timeline on when you might start having some of that technology to roll out?
We have started negotiations with different companies, and obviously we're trying to do that as soon as possible. We want to get some of this work started in the field with grower cooperators who can trial some of this tech so that we can start developing and validating them in the field and developing case studies to share with others in the industry about how those technologies are performing.
So are you in discussions with growers about who potentially might be interested in trialling this technology on farm?
Yeah, we currently have an expression of interest program that's open to Australian vegetable growers. So that they just sort of scan a QR code and then takes that to a range of questions that just gives us some more information about what sort of issues they're trying to address through automation and mechanisation and a little bit about their farming system to help sort of align with whatever technologies that we can source.
So just talk me through this study tour you recently went on and where it was, what it involved and when you got back.
Yeah, so the study tour, it's very, very recent. The tour was to California where we actually visited a range of different horticultural farming operations. And then we finished up with a couple of days at the International Field Robotics Forum, or FIRA, in the USA. And so at that particular site, there was a whole range of different technologies that we were able to see live. People could ask questions about, what they can do. And so that was just really beneficial to finish off the tour.
Talk me through specifically what you saw over there that you thought may be transferable to Australian farms and could work in Australian agriculture.
Yeah, so there's a range of technologies that we saw over there. Some of these are commercial already. So we were looking at smart spraying technologies where you use AI vision systems to identify and target the application of different chemicals. That sort of technology also works like to target weeds, but also if you're actually targeting plants for applications such as fungicides and things like that. We also saw a range of laser weeder options, so moving away from using chemistry. Some of those are commercial, others are still in the pipeline, so that was really interesting just to see what's available and coming through the system there. And we also looked at an option for sort of increasing mechanisation in planting systems, so that was really interesting as well.
So what was the one that the growers who were there with you got the most excited about?
Because much of our vegetable cropping is still hand harvested, anything that can sort of take away and assist with reducing labour in that sort of area is always very exciting. There's a lot sort of in development still. Other than that, I suppose some of the smart spraying technology was really interesting, and laser weeding options as well, and what's sort of coming through there.
Laser weeding does sound fun. That's Queensland's Department of Primary Industries Principal Development Horticulturalist Julie O'Halloran speaking to Ashley Bagshaw. It's 1:15. This is the Queensland Country Hour. Now, that's what's happening for vegetable growers. On the fruit side, a Far North Queensland banana farmer is fostering a community for women in the industry. Jenny Kremer is reinvigorating the Australian Banana Growers Council's Banana Women's Network and bringing it to it things that she's learnt from her recent study in the National Farmers Federation's Diversity in Agriculture Leadership Program. And as she explains to Bridget Herman, the network started in 2017 as a social avenue for banana businesswomen, but it's growing to focus on networking and other professional opportunities.
We are, you know, based on the challenges that we face in the complexities of modern day farming, we're at the moment ABGC staff and founding members of the group like myself are focused on developing vision for that group and facilitating change to drive that group into the future, making sure that it's sort of well aligned and responsive to the needs of the group.
Looking at the needs of, you know, female banana growers, what kind of roles are they tending to have on the farms, and what sort of development are you looking to do there?
We're looking to firstly celebrate our role in the industry, recognise that our roles on the farm are quite complex, and due to those complexities, we need to sort of capitalise on networking opportunities that give us strength to make meaningful connections with each other and engage with a diverse range of industry stakeholders, I guess.
Yeah, because networking is such an important part of advancing your career in agriculture, you would say, is that right?
Yes, for sure.
Mm. And look, this is for banana growers in North Queensland, but you got a lot of learnings from this leadership diversity program to bring back to this. What did you learn in that program?
So I learned a lot of things in that program. The program was sort of focused on developing our skills as leaders, sort of embracing leadership styles, leadership skills, networking and mentoring opportunities to elevate us into leadership roles in agricultural ranks. So we were partnered with a mentor. My mentor was Sarah Corcoran. She's the CEO of Plant Health Australia. And with Sarah, we explored lots of opportunities to develop my skills and strengths to participate in industry.
Look, this is, you know, you're starting here in North Queensland with banana growers. Are you looking to keep it just for women in that specific industry?
As a broader goal from the program, it's my vision to try and embrace women across the Cassowary Coast in a wide range of sectors, sort of bring together people to empower us with more networking opportunities to make us richer as business people and industry people. So just sort of coming together, explore opportunities to come together as a collective, possibly women in ag across the Cassowary Coast.
Sounds like you'll get a bunch of them together. Please forgive me for that pun. That's Jenny Kremer, who runs Tully Banana Growers with her husband, Adrian, speaking to Bridget Herman. Up next, another Queensland woman that's done something pretty special, 3 years running.
They didn't want me up on stage.
My autism makes it hard.
I know how hard it is being a musician living with a disability.
Ellie Mae Barnes is breaking sound barriers and going after the dream.
forming two bands in just 7 weeks to play a sellout festival.
It's huge!
Come in hard and come in big.
An Oz Music Month special. Headliners.
This is where I'm supposed to be.
Wow. Starts Tuesday, November 19 on ABC TV. And always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour with Kelly Buchanan on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Time to celebrate a Queenslander who's taken out the Australian Professional Rodeo Association's barrel racing and all-round cowgirl titles, but it's not her first celebration. In fact, it's the third year in a row that Leanne Caven has claimed those titles. She grew up around Julia Creek and did her schooling around Charters Towers, and Michael Clark asked her what it felt like to take out those wins.
It's surreal. That's the third year in a row that I've claimed those two titles. So it was a long wait to actually claim a barrel racing title, and then now to claim three in a row, it's something pretty special.
Yeah, indeed. It stamps you as a leader in the field, really, doesn't it? I can imagine everyone in competition with you is thinking, well, she's definitely one to watch because she's holding these titles.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I've been around for a long time, so I've got a fair bit of experience.
Well, let's talk about your experience, because I didn't want to jump in, first of all, and talk about age, but you are over 50, you're 56, and claiming these titles. How special is that for you to be able to do that?
Oh, it certainly is. Look, I've got some really, really dear friends that can't compete anymore, and I'm sure, you know, they would really like to be competing, so I feel that I'm really blessed with my health that I can keep going and do it with my family as well.
What is it that you think is the secret to your success that keeps you fit and healthy and able to do this?
I guess because I've kept doing it. That's probably the biggest thing. When I was younger, I used to do a lot of other things, running and stuff like that to keep myself fit. But I figure now I'm doing enough riding and I've got a lot of young horses to keep going. So I ride nearly every day and that seems to keep me fit.
Was it something you always did? Take us back to how this association with rodeoing began.
I didn't come from a rodeo family, but my father and mother both enjoyed horses. My dad, he done as a bit of a hobby, trained a few racehorses out in Julia Creek, so I rode track work for him. But before that, Mum would take us to pony club and stuff like that. My two brothers, they didn't like the horses very much, so they went into motorbikes and golf and football and stuff like that and riding those motorbikes was a big thing for them. So I didn't come from a rodeo family, but I just loved horses. So that just was an avenue. Once I left boarding school, I found rodeo, and that was what I wanted to pursue.
And this continues your love affair with horses. How important is the ride to a success like yours?
Well, yeah, I guess that passion for horses is definitely something that gets in your blood, and I've had some success with a particular mare. Then I've bred from that mare, and I've got a bit of a legacy going on with her now. So I guess I'm going to be in it for a long time to come. And my son and daughter, they both rodeo, and my daughter has just won the rookie cowgirl of the Australian Professional Rodeo Association as well. She ran the all-round rookie cowgirl and the barrel racing titles as well this year. So that's something very special to us as well.
Oh, that's brilliant. You're forming a dynasty, Leanne.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, I'm sure now that, you know, my husband come from a rodeo family. His dad was an all-round cowboy, and the Cabins are a fairly well-known name down in the New South Wales northern area. So I guess we have built a dynasty from rodeo now, and it'll stay with us forever, I think.
It seems to me too that it's a sport that attracts both men and women. What's it like with female participation in the sport?
Yeah, it is. It's something that you can do on a level playing ground, I guess. And even though we don't, you know, there aren't a lot of girls over here that bronc ride and bull ride and stuff like that, but they certainly They certainly do start out doing that as younger in their junior years. There's girls that have done that and they've gone overseas and done that as well. But, yeah, we, you know, we as a family, we all rope together. We train horses together. So, you know, it is something, you know, special that you can both do it, you know, as a male and female and do it as a family.
Yeah, Leanne, you love the horses. Never tempted to ride a bull?
No, that doesn't interest me one bit, especially at my age.
I'm glad to hear that. I'd be worried if you said you did. And so let's give a shout out to the horse. Winning these titles, who were you riding?
I was riding my good horse. He's registered as Mourne's Akadaka Rock. And we bought him as a two-year-old from Santa Rio Quarter Horses. And, yeah, he's been something very special. He did have some spinal issues. So he got had kissing spine. And we had surgery back in 2019 and COVID come around at that time. So he had the luxury of having that 12 months of rehabilitation without the pressure of trying to get him back early. And he has come back bigger and better than ever.
That is a great story. How much is it success for you and how much does the horse contribute to winning a title?
I would say the combination is very important. I've got to be a good jockey to be able to jockey that horse to win as well. But that horse is so consistent and, you know, loves his job. So that is probably, you know, 95% of it. If the horse actually enjoys what they're doing, it makes my job a whole lot easier.
Congratulations. That's Leanne Caven, who has claimed the title of the Australian Professional Rodeo Association's Barrel Racing and All-Round Cowgirl Champion. It's the third year in a row she's taken out those titles. She was speaking there to Michael Clark. This is the Queensland Country Hour. Let's head to the markets next. Now to Blackall, where Sam Hart is at the sale yards.
Good afternoon. 1,000 head were yarded for the prime and store sale at Blackall this week. The majority of the yarding was made up of prime cows and grown steers, alongside one large consignment of heavy feeder steers. All the usual export buyers were present and operating, and there was strong competition from local restockers for feeder cattle. A limited number of lightweight restockers, steers and heifers were on offer, with a top price of $352.2 for steers 280 to 330 kilos, while a large run of heavy feeder steers were a standout, selling to $362.2. Heavy ground steers to the processors sold to $312.2 to average $305, and ground heifers sold to an isolated $320.2 with most around 285 cents. Local and southern restockers were more active on store cows this week, selling to $242.2 to average $234. Medium weight cows topped at $265.2 to average $252. And heavy cows topped at $280.2 to average $271. Bulls sold to 258 cents. This has been Sam Huff, the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Sam. Let's head to the weekly Warwick sheep sale. Here's Errol Luck.
The useful falls of rain across the usual supply area reduced numbers at Warwick to 1,061 lambs and 692 grown sheep. All the regular processors and wholesalers attended along with local restockers and feeder buyers. With a heavy hailstorm holding the sale for a time, prices for the trade and heavy lambs improved and sold to dearer trends along with hoggets and heavy ewes to processors. Young lambs to restockers also sold to dearer prices. Lightweight young lambs to restockers sold from 70 to 98 and young lambs in the 16 to 18 range to the wholesale meat trade sold from 100 to 128 with those over 18 kilos at 132 to 137 and the best of the new season lambs to butcher trade sold to 171. Older lambs in the 18 to 22 kilo range to the wholesale meat trade sold from 138 to 196 and trade weight lambs sold from 194 to 205 with the heavy crossbred lambs at 165 to 232. Hogs to processors sold 104 to 155, lightweight ewes to processors sold from 20 to 54, the heavy ewes at 60 to 80, and crossbred wethers to processors sold from 68 to 87. This has been Errol Luck from the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Errol, and that just about wraps it up for the Queensland Country Hour. Before I go, though, I want to let you know the drama is continuing at COP29 in Azerbaijan. Argentina's president has recalled his delegation from the UN Climate Summit. The Undersecretary for the Environment, Ana Lamas, says she's received instructions from the foreign ministry but has not been given a reason. But it is worth noting that President Javier Milei has previously said global warming is a socialist lie. So the drama continuing. It's going to be an interesting couple of weeks in Azerbaijan. I'll keep an eye on it for you. And you can keep listening to ABC Radio right now for the latest in your news. I'll be back on the radio from midday tomorrow. And in the meantime, get all your rural news online at abc.net.au/rural and tune in for your rural report at 6:15 tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.